Did Governor DeSantis break Florida's sunshine laws this morning when he signed the state's new voting law? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The governor held an event in Palm Beach County today where a group of his supporters showed up to watch the signing. The media was kept out, except Fox News. The governor actually signed it on live TV. We're going to look at the new voting law and the governor's relationship with the media. Also, Charlie Crist is running for governor again. Are Floridians still on board with the former Republican and independent? Finally, we return to a live from the 305.
I guess it's the people that are from here, like, we don't give up. That's why that whole 305 till I die thing is real.
Today, we hear from Haute Tension. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for joining us today. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law a new voting bill today, placing restrictions on vote-by-mail ballots and enhancing voter ID requirements. DeSantis argued the bill is necessary to protect Florida's election system. Democratic lawmakers call it Jim Crow 2.0. Unless you were watching Fox and Friends this morning, you may have missed the announcement. That's because the governor gave the announcement as a Fox News exclusive, barring all of the media outlets from covering the event in West Palm Beach. Gary Feinout is a reporter with Politico and the author of Florida Playbook, and he joins us now. Gary, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Gary, it's not uncommon for a governor to have a closed-door session for a bill signing, but how unusual is it to give a news exclusive for an official government activity like that?
This is very unusual. Governor DeSantis himself even acknowledged a little bit later today, after that event, that it was the first time he'd ever done a live bill signing with on television with a network like that. It is unprecedented, and it speaks volumes to the relationship that Governor DeSantis has with the media. As you know, he holds a lot of the media with a bit of disdain, and he has been highly critical of what he calls the Estella media or the corporate media. And so he was asked in Panama City why they gave an exclusive to Fox with the bill signing. And he said, well, he didn't really answer the question. He just said they were happy to do it. And interestingly enough, Fox News apparently put out a statement that said that they didn't ask for an exclusive.
So, I mean, do the actions by the governor and his staff violate Florida's sunshine laws, which require high levels of transparency for government officials?
In terms of the Florida sunshine law, it's important to note that law primarily applies to records and to meetings. So the best way to describe it is that if you have a local city commission or the county commission, you can't have two members of that board meeting in private to discuss pending business. When it comes to the governor and a bill signing, no, there's nothing in law that requires him to do it in public. And in fact, many times, especially on slightly more controversial bills, you'll have a private bill signing. I believe there was some restrictions on abortion in the governor's first year that he signed in a closed door ceremony that he held in his office in Tallahassee. So, again, from a sunshine law standpoint, no, it's not violating the provisions in that law. It's just a matter of, on such a high-profile bill, it's just kind of interesting that you would have an event where there were actually hundreds of people in attendance. It was almost like a campaign rally. And they let all these supporters come in to watch him do it. And they let Fox News in, but then they tell the regular news media, you can't come in.
Yeah. I mean, is that an ethical problem for the governor, mixing this official business with what looks like campaigning?
I'll leave that to someone else to delve in from a legal standpoint. I mean, I wasn't in attendance at the event. I mean, obviously I watched it on Fox and Friends. I saw some of the media on the ground tweet out pictures of people wearing "I'm for Governor DeSantis." I think the question is who organized it and how was it built? I mean, as I understand it, it was organized with the help of a Trump club, fan club in West Palm Beach. So, I mean, you get into this whole thing. I mean, and it wasn't done on state property. That would probably be the other thing that you would have to say. Did he do it inside? If he had done this inside the governor's office, where he had like a campaign style event, or somewhere in a state building. But again, I'm not an expert on this. But you know, we have run into this kind of stuff a little bit. We had a little bit of this stuff in 2014 with Rick Scott as well.
Yeah. So how does the move fall into this strategy by DeSantis, similar to what we saw with President Trump, create a combative relationship with the mainstream media?
Oh, well, I think there's a lot in common in terms of, I mean, I haven't heard him go so far as to, you know, call members of the media enemies of the people. But what he has done on multiple occasions is he has sort of, he's castigated the media, and he has gotten very upset with some of the coverage that's come his way. I think the most notable example is that he was highly critical of a story about Florida's vaccine distribution that appeared on 60 Minutes. He had an entire press conference where he basically ripped into the 60 Minutes. Yeah, and now it can be argued that the way that story was done, I mean, there's arguments as to what was the main premise of the story, and did they really prove their premise? But I'm not here for media criticism, but I'm just saying that that is an example of how combative he is, and he's done it. I mean, it's been during the entire pandemic. I mean, we can go all the way back to that time that he was in Orlando with Vice President Pence, and there's some questions about a former state employee and her assertions and what have you, and he just went off on a reporter. So it's something we've been seeing a lot for the last 14 months.
I'm talking with Politico Florida editor Gary Fineout. Governor Ron DeSantis signed a new bill into law today, changing the state's voting process. As the event was made a Fox News exclusive, all other media outlets were barred. You could read more of his reporting on our social media, WLRN Sundial. All right, so this bill was widely expected for him to sign it, so no surprise there. But let's talk about what this new law is and what changes it's going to do to Florida's voting system, particularly to drop boxes. But what's different now?
Well, what's different now is there has been a lot of attention focused on the drop boxes. I think it's important to note that some of the more serious restrictions related to drop boxes did not make it into the final bill. At one point in time, the Senate wanted to get rid of them altogether. Then the House wanted to have all sorts of ID requirements. In other words, they wanted to make it that if you wanted to drop a ballot off at a drop box, you had to show ID to even put it in the box itself. Now, they got rid of that. But what they did is they limited the times that drop boxes are going to be available. Now, it's important to point out that there was a dispute last year over the existing law and how drop boxes were supposed to be used. The Department of State in October of 2020 issued guidance to supervisors and said, look, their read of the bill that authorized drop boxes, which was in 2019, they basically said, look, we think they have to be monitored by somebody. Now, the new law has the monitoring, but the other thing that it does is it also says you can only, during the early voting period, you can only do it when you have early voting hours at those facilities. You can have it longer at the main supervisor's office. But for those, I think most people think about these drop boxes, they think about, okay, I can go by an early voting site, and instead of actually getting in line and actually going in, I can just go put it in the box and go. That's only going to be limited to whenever early voting is allowed in those counties.
You know, we have a primary election that's coming up to replace Representative Alcee Hastings' seat in August. I believe that the actual election's coming up in January, if I'm not mistaken. And then, of course, the gubernatorial elections. But what impact do you think this new law is going to have on voter turnout? For these kind of elections, you usually don't have high turnout.
Yeah, in the primary and general election to replace Alcee Hastings, yeah, I, that's going to be an interesting thing to see how much time. I mean, you normally that could be as low as 15 to 20% turnout in terms of how many people are going to turn out for that race.
Do you think this new law is going to have an impact on that?
Somewhat. I think the way that I don't know how the Dropbox is provisions are going to play out. About 1.5 million people use Dropboxes in the 2020 presidential. I think the provision that they call, quote, ballot harvesting, the provision dealing with that, I think that potentially could have a bigger impact. And that's essentially basically in Florida. Now, not in Miami-Dade, because Miami-Dade already has pretty stringent restrictions on the collection of absentee ballots, which is a result of some scandals in Miami back in the 90s. But basically, the rest of the state's going to be in a position where if you are a volunteer, if you are a neighbor, if you are a friend, you can only pick up two ballots and return them on behalf of somebody, two mail-in ballots and return them. The law used to be was that you couldn't pay someone to do it, but there was nothing that said that volunteers couldn't collect ballots. That is now gone. So I think for campaigns that would rely on volunteers to help pick up ballots, I think it definitely could have an impact. And in the lawsuits that have been filed, they talk a lot about, well, they think it's going to affect elderly voters, disabled voters, people who can't normally get out. If they have to try to, you know, how are they going to get their ballots? Now, again, you're still able to mail ballots in, but as we saw with the 2020 election, there was a lot of concern about the Postal Service and how quickly they could return ballots.
Do you think the law can have an adverse effect on Republican voters, given the large numbers that had voted by mail?
I had seen some arguments about that and some suggestions that there are some people who are worried about how that could affect. There's no doubt that Republicans, for up until 2020, they excelled at mail-in ballots. And what it's important to remember, it is the Republican Florida legislature that changed the law that allowed the system we have now. A lot of people may not remember this, but there was a time that the only way you could get a mail-in ballot in Florida is you had to have, quote, an excuse. You had to sign a form saying, look, I can't make it to the polls. After the 2000 election shenanigans, as we should call it, they eventually, in the early 2000s, they changed the law and they opened up absentee balloting to practically everyone. So, the Republicans did a really bang up job at getting people to vote by mail. Now, what's interesting though is in the last two elections, even before the President Trump's, you know, criticisms of mail-in ballot, even before that, you were seeing a trend where Republicans were gravitating more to in-person voting. You saw an uptick in the amount of Republicans who were using early voting and who were actually showing up at the polls on election day. The last couple of elections in Florida, the Republicans have had a pretty hefty turnout on election day. But in 2020, you saw Republicans actually outperformed Democrats in early voting in 2020.
So there are already a number of lawsuits filed by different groups like the League of Women Voters and others against this law. What's the possibility for the Florida Supreme Court to block the legislation before those elections?
Well, both the lawsuits have been filed in federal court, not in state court. So, I mean, we'll have to see. I mean, I don't want to go off on a tangent. There's been some standards that have been changed about standing, who has the authority to sue. And I think the issue is, can these groups prove that these changes are going to have a disproportionate effect upon certain groups? Is it going to make it harder for minorities to vote? Is it going to make it harder for disabled people to vote? There's one of the lawsuits that's led by the NAACP. In fact, point blank says they feel that this is a violation of the Americans with Disability Act. So that's, you know, I really can't predict what a federal judge is going to say. I mean, we saw what happened with the 2019 law on felon voting. It was struck down as solidly unconstitutional by the judge here up in Tallahassee. And then on a 6-4 vote by the entire appeals court in Atlanta, that ruling was reversed and the law was upheld.
And of course, going through the courts means it could take a while. Again, I'm talking with political reporter Gary Fineout. Stick around, though, Gary, because we're going to talk more politics. We're going to switch things up. We're going to talk about governors. We're going to talk about a former governor who's running for office again. Just want to mention, too, by the way, that there is a little bit of trouble with the signal right now, 91.3 signal. Engineers are working on it. We're going to keep you updated on that signal when it's fixed, but we are streaming online, WLRN.org, so please check us out there. Still to come, a familiar face in Florida politics re-entering the ring, Charlie Crist running for governor again. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
This won't be an easy fight, but nothing in life worth fighting for is easy.
For anyone who has lived in Florida more than a decade, that voice is familiar. Charlie Crist, the Democratic congressman from St. Petersburg, is running for governor for the third time. His first campaign back in 2007 was successful, and he was considered widely popular. However, a run for Senate as an independent and a run for governor as a Democrat, he was unable to garner the same support. So, 2022, is it going to be a different story? Charles Zeldin is a history and political science professor at Nova Southeastern University, and he joins us now. Charles, thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Also, Gary Fineout from Politico, still with us as well. Charles, I want to start with you. We go back to the early 2000s. Crist ran as a Republican for governor. He had previous experience as a secretary of education in the state. What did he originally campaign on? What was his big thing?
Really just a continuation of what had already been the case under Jeb Bush. He kind of promised more of the same. He didn't really try and stand out much from it, but sort of follow through in the Republicans have been good for the state message.
And he was popular, at least, you know, during his first stint. What were some of the policies that he championed while in office that put him up there so high with the Floridians?
Well, he continued the policies of Jeb Bush, which is to say a low tax environment. But he also began to take on certain problems that a lot of people thought were needed fixing. For example, the clemency process for those who had been convicted of a felony. It wasn't like we have today where there's a move to get rid of felony disenfranchisement, but rather what he wanted to do was to make the process by which somebody who had served their time, who had lived a clean life, could more easily get clemency. And in the process, over about 100,000 individuals received their right to vote again. And that was generally seen as a good thing on both sides of the aisle, in part because it was sort of evenly split as to which parties these individuals were likely to back once they had the vote.
Gary, you know, Crist, again, popular in his early stint, but then President Obama comes into office and you see a new form of conservatism that's emerging. What impact did the Tea Party have on Charlie Crist and his popularity among Republicans?
Well, I was pointed out, he was a sort of, he was a Republican who kind of kept the course. Although the other things he did is he took on the property insurance and property taxes. He was very instrumental in both of those issues. And in fact, he kind of took a more, and you could kind of see the way he was going. He went for a more populist kind of brand, even in the Republicans. And what he did was, is he went after insurance companies. He expanded the reach of some of the state-run entities in insurance. And then when the Great Recession hit, he embraced the stimulus. He saw it as a way to bolster the budget so that he did not have to have huge budget cuts as a result of Florida's economy collapsing, the housing market collapsing. So he basically made the political calculation to support Obama, support the stimulus. And boy, did he pay a price for it. I mean, he even acknowledges he invited the president to, or well, the president came to Florida. Chris was at a rally with him. He hugged him. He talked about how great it was to have all this money. He made a political calculation that he thought the electric in Florida was becoming more moderate. What happened, as you know, is that there was a backlash against Obama and the Tea Party came along. And then all of a sudden, and then Chris made the decision to run for Senate as opposed to staying in the governor. I think there's a lot of people who think if he had run for governor as a second term, he probably could have weathered the storm. But by going for by going after the Senate race, here comes Rubio. Rubio upends everything, chases Crist from the Republican Party. He runs as an independent, and it's a three-way race between Kendrick Meek, Charlie Crist, Marco Rubio, and then there you go. And then we go on that whole change path. Then he eventually becomes a Democrat, runs as governor, loses, and then he gets a job in Congress.
Yeah,
it's quite the evolution. I mean, there are a lot of positions that he took 15, 20 years ago that are not anywhere near the positions he takes now.
Yeah, and of course that the hug with Obama, that one, of course, his opponents use that over and over and over again. Again, we're talking with Politico reporter Gary Fineout. Also joining us is Charles Zeldin, history and political science professor at Nova Southeastern University. Just want to mention real quickly, because there were some issues with our 91.3 WLRN signal, it is back. So just wanted to mention that if you missed any of the portion of the segment before this, don't worry. The show re-airs again tonight at 8, so you can listen then, or you can always find the podcast on your podcast app and go back and listen to that. You know what? I wanted to come back to that, the fact that Florida has a massive no political affiliation voter base. Charles, how successful have independents been in running campaigns in the past?
Not very. In large part because while we have a lot of people who do not have party affiliation, they generally tend to lean towards one or the other party. So they don't want to name themselves a Democrat or a Republican. But come election time, they're going to likely vote for one or the other party depending on their preferences. There aren't a lot of true independents who would flip between the parties readily. And so it's hard to run and be successful as an independent. Rather, what you need to do is you need to run as a Democrat or Republican who can reach out to those independent voters and get that middle 15 to 20% that is a flippable vote to flip your way. And that often is the difference in the 40, 50, or 60,000 votes between winning and losing.
Charles, why did Chris ultimately decide to run as a Democrat in 2014 against Rick Scott? I mean, did his policies align with the Democratic Party, or was he getting pushed really far off from the right?
He had been driven from the Republican Party. There was no way he could run as a Republican. And not just because of people's attitudes towards him and the hug, but also because what had been very mainline Republican when he was governor, now was beginning to be seen as kind of, not a rhino, kind of swishy, you know, not really where the Republicans were heading. He was too moderate to be a Republican. And so if he wanted to win, he had to pick the other party. And so he switched the Democrats, where he came in as a more conservative or moderate conservative side of the Democratic Party, but he fit with the Democrats, at least an element of the Democrats. And it was really a question of, if you want to win office, which is the first rule of politics, you got to run and you got to win if you want to play the game. He had to make the choice, and he did. And he came within one percentage point of winning the governor's race, we have to remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't like it was a blowout.
Right. No. Well, like a lot of governors, at least recent gubernatorial elections here in Florida. Gary, I mean, Chris is the first to jump into the race. We believe that Orlando Congresswoman Val Demings and Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried will also be putting their names in that hat. But we don't know yet, and we don't know how many altogether. How does Chris, just looking at those two names, though, Demings and Fried, how does Chris stack up against them?
Well, I think it's important to note that, Nikki Fried did win a statewide election in 2018, but it was a down ballot race and it was an extraordinarily close election. And then Val Demings, while she has I think there are a lot of Democrats who are excited about the prospect of Val Demings potentially running. There's a lot of factors that we don't quite know. I mean, Crist is a proven fundraiser. Crist is somebody who likes to campaign. He's always been very good at that element of the job. And the question is I think it's very plausible to think that Val Demings is going to get a fair amount of national recognition and national support if she runs. But still, it's going to be interesting to see, how she's going to what kind of resources she's going to have and how quickly can she put together an organization. And I think with Fried's, I don't know what her resources are going to be like either. So, I mean, on the surface, you would think that it could potentially could be a rough road for Crist based upon if the race has these other people in it. Now, what happens if it's only one of them gets in? Then maybe the calculus changes. It's just a matter of, I think there's no doubt there's an element to the party that they would rather support somebody else. The people, especially on the progressive end, they're going to probably be looking for a different brand out of the Democrats. But what we can say is whoever is the nominee, I don't know how difficult it's going to be to rally at least the Democratic base to their side, even if there is a bit of a contentious primary, because right now with everything that's been going on and the alliance between Trump and DeSantis, there will be a level of intensity on the Democratic side to vote out DeSantis.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not that'll be enough to win, I don't know, but I have no doubts that once the Democrats settle on the nominee, a lot of Democrats are going to come home.
Yeah, Charles, you think if Crist wins, is he trying to, because it seems like both parties are going off to the far right and far left. Does Crist have to try to appeal to the moderate side of the Democratic base, or is he just trying to flip those NPA voters?
Oh, he'll have to apply himself to the moderate and as much as possible progressive wing of the Florida Democratic Party. He needs them if he's going to get the nomination. And then if he's going to win the race, although I agree with Gary, the Democrats are going to vote extensively in the general election, no matter who is running. In many ways, it's best to think that he's trying to fill the road or the lane that Gwen Graham was trying to fill in the last election cycle. This moderate Democrat who can reach out to the center, who might be able to reach out to disaffected Republicans, and create a coalition that can get the 1% above instead of the 1% below victory for the Democrats. And I think that's going to be his strategy.
Gary, if Crist is able to secure the nomination, then obviously he's going to be going up against likely Governor Ron DeSantis. But we don't know, because is DeSantis have ambitions for the White House, and not just as president? If Trump does run, there's word that DeSantis could be the running mate.
Well, yeah, Trump made that comment saying that if he ran again, that he might consider DeSantis as a running mate, which, I think was viewed a little bit as a sort of a backhanded slap at Pence. So clearly there is a lot of buzz on the Republican side about DeSantis as a possible 2024 contender. And that's something he's going to have to ask when he runs in 2022 is, is this going to be, are you only going to be around a couple of years because you're going to try to leave and run for higher office? So, perhaps other people can vouch for whether or not that's a big issue or not. I'm not necessarily seeing a lot of poll testing on, that met, but I there is some element of people who are like, they want to know if you're going to do the job for all 4 years. And so I think that is a question that could come up. But I think the important thing is that the situation is whoever the Democratic nominee is, DeSantis is, he's going to have a tremendous amount of resources. And he's, you know, I think to me, the biggest question for DeSantis against whomever is the Democratic nominee is what happens with the Trump voters of 2020? You know, what is that turnout? I mean, we saw, you know, not, you know, the best record for turnout, but we saw pretty high turnout in 2020. A lot of those people who helped Republicans in 2020, will they be there in 2022? And that's what I'm wondering, you know, what's going to happen with that Trump coalition that delivered the state for him in this last election?
Charles, I wanted to ask you this question about comparisons. Do you see similarities or big differences between when you had the Rick Scott and Charlie Crist matchup in 2014 compared to if you see a DeSantis Crist matchup in 2022? And again, because I look back at, you know, what was happening when he was running against Scott, yet the Tea Party movement was big. If he's running against DeSantis now, it's, you know, you're talking about, you know, the Trump movement is big.
Well, yeah, I mean, the similarities are there, but as Gary pointed out, how solid will the Trump constituency be in Florida when Trump isn't running? We don't know. I'm not saying it won't be there. In fact, I suspect it will be there to a certain extent, but how much will it be there? It doesn't take much for there to be a real close race and a possibility of a narrow win by the Democrat. It can happen. It's a, you know, elections are won by those who show up. And while I wouldn't bet against the Republicans showing up, will they show up in all the numbers they did when Trump was on the ballot, as opposed to when Trump isn't on the ballot? That we don't know. And it would only take a percentage or so of those voters not showing up to make a big difference in the outcome of the race.
Yeah.
Because generally you'd expect a smaller turnout in a race, midterm race like this, than you would in a presidential.
And of course, here we are talking about this race, which is still some time away. But, you know, that's how politics work, you know, in the United States. One election ends, we're already getting ready for the next one. I want to thank my guest, first history and political science professor Charles Zeldin at Nova Southeastern University, and Gary Fineout, Politico reporter and author of The Florida Playbook. Charles, Gary, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, just a reminder, tomorrow, the Florida Roundup has an interview with gubernatorial candidate Charlie Crist. You can tune in at noon to hear that discussion. Now, you know, with topics like this and the one that we had earlier about the governor signing the voting law, we always want to hear from you, your thoughts about what you're hearing in the news. The best way to do it is through the Sundial Text Club. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, just hello to 786-677-0767. Let us know what you think about the program, what you hear on the program, or maybe some of the ideas that you have. You might be on a show in the future. Well, still to come, let's switch gears up as we approach the weekend and introduce you to Haute Tension, our latest in the series, live from the 305. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Now, let's take a listen to a little surf noir. Now, picture the waves crashing, and it's getting dark. The sun's setting. It's free spirit with a little bit of dangerous mystery. The band Haute Tension thrives on meshing these contrasts into their music. That word, by the way, Haute Tension, it means high voltage in French. And their self-titled debut record was independently released and named the best local album 2019 by the Miami New Times. The group is the latest in our series Live from the 305, celebrating the artists that shape South Florida's music scene. And we spoke with the band members a while back, Monica McGivern, Alex Mabuti, and Nabidi Osadio, late last year. Nabidi began by telling us how her environment has influenced her music.
I guess being from Miami and seeing all the diversity throughout my life, I've seen the punk rock scene be huge and then it died out. And then the rave scene was big and then it died out. And then, you know, there's always been like a hip hop scene. There's always been a Spanish scene. So for me, like, I've always been involved in every aspect of every genre. So I see it as a melting pot. And a lot of people do have that perception that Miami is only like Latin music or maybe like some rap music or whatever, or reggaeton even, which that's a whole other subject on its own. But I've really seen the diversity that the city has and all the little pockets that it has because I'm born and raised here. And I've seen all the different moves that have happened throughout the scene, growing, disappearing, coming back, disappearing. But now it's really special because we have so many people that have become implants from other places and they've brought their influences, and a lot more people are moving down here. So there's even more diversity at this point, which is really great to see what's happening.
So let me start with you, though. Stay with you. How did you guys come together? How did this group find each other?
Magic. So I'm not going to go too far into their history because that's how they really started, but they were already established as a band, and they were going to change their band name, as well as they recorded an album with a new band name, and they were looking for a touring drummer to go out to promote that album, which is the self-titled Hot Tension, Hot Tension album. And they put an ad out on Facebook. Really quickly, Monica and I were already working together through the Miami Girls Rock Camp. And Alex and I kind of knew each other through the scene, but we weren't really, like, you know, friends. But we had full respect of one another as musicians. What brought us together was the call out on Facebook. And people were suggesting me. And then I'm like, I'm here. So we did a 31-day tour. And our very first show was July 29th of 2018. Yeah. And then we went on tour for the month of August, from August 1st to August 31st, we did 34 shows total, all in Miami, in places that you wouldn't even expect we threw shows, and it was amazing. On the 31st day, we released the album, and we've been together ever since. We decided to stay together as a band because it just worked so well together.
Perfect. Alex, let me come to you. Tell me about, I mean, Hot Tension, Hot Tension, what is that mean exactly?
So we first came across the name when, like Nabetti mentioned, we were changing the name as a band. Monica and I had started just us two as Mo Booty, and that was just literally our names put together, like the end of my last name, Mer Booty, and the beginning of Monica, Mo. And when we started bringing other people into the band and touring and the sound started changing, we wanted a name that represented kind of, that better represented the band and the sound and the energy, which was very high energy. And so we were in France and we saw this sign that was a high voltage sign from like train tracks, but in French it was Haute Tension. And it said danger de mort, which is like danger of death. But it was a square red sign, and it was just really striking. And it was like, it looked like an album cover almost. And it was like perfect. And so we were like, damn, Haute Tension, that would be a kind of a cool name for a band. And that kind of stuck with us when we came home and we were putting all the stuff together to release the album. And we're really thinking of changing the name. We're like, this is it. If we're going to do it, it's got to be when we release the album and just come out guns a-blazing.
Always interesting how ideas come to us. It's in the strangest of places. Monica, so my understanding is, I mean, when I look at the description of your style, you know, it's described as surf noir. I mean, is that fair to say? Can you say that you fit in a genre?
I mean, a genre, I think, is just a marketing tool, you know, used by PR agents and music journalists. And so, yeah, it's more of a marketing tool. The most broad range we would say would be rock and roll, you know, just keeping live music and that rock and roll spirit alive. But for people that are more familiar with the music industry, Surf Noir does describe our sound. You know, the guitar is loud and the traditional Dick Dale type of style. And the noir crosses an international representation, but it still stays true to the punk mentality of, you know, just...
You know what? I wanted to play a little bit of Dano, and let's play a little bit of this. So we get a sense of, because again, for anybody who doesn't know, you know, how, again, you, I guess you would describe surf noir. Here's a little bit of it. You know, it's I get that sense of the punk and jazz. And I mean, it seems to me like, I wonder today, can we even have genres? Monica, I'll start with you, considering like everything bleeds into each other anyway these days.
It's true. Yeah. I think about, again, I go to the visual art aspect and, you know, memes and mashup culture, the internet, I think, has changed us in a way, and that's just the time that we're at.
Now, Betty, I love the drum beat in this song. You know what I mean. Tell us a little bit about it's a slow, jazzy tempo. Tell me a little bit about that.
Cody Mentolos is a drummer that recorded on that album. Naturally, I learned the parts, but of course, on live settings, I add my own flair because as musicians, like, we listen to what's happening, but we all have our own flavor. So I try to keep it as true as possible, but obviously adding my own thing to it. So it might have, like, changed a little bit when you watch us live, and the energy is obviously different. Every musician's different, so they're going to perform differently and everything, but... those are great drum beats.
I'm speaking with Alex Mabuti, Monica McGivern, and Nebedi Osorio from the band Haute Tension. That's French for high voltage. Their self-titled debut record was independently released and named the best local album 2019 by the Miami New Times. This conversation is part of our series, Live from the 305. And you can find a link to their music on our social media at WLRN Sundial.
I've heard about this, you know, from performers. It's like from performance to performance, you know, you can alter things. I guess, is it depend on the energy of the room or what mood you're in that day?
Most definitely. All those things contribute to a performance. And things can happen at the moment, and that's what we call improv. And I might drop a stick, and you might think that that was a really cool sound that I did, but that's because I dropped a stick, but I didn't stop playing. So you're like, oh, that was so cool. And I'm like, yeah, I planned that. You know, so things happen, but you just got to keep going with it, you know? And the element of surprise is always something to expect when you're performing because you never really know what's happening when you jump on a stage. Or fall off a stage, which that's a whole nother topic.
Let me go to this other song now, History. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, also what you're feeling when you're performing this in a studio compared to live.
So in the studio with a specific recording, we recorded it one instrument at a time. We tracked the drums first. The second day I laid the bass lines, and the third and fourth day, we did guitars and some auxiliary percussion. So it was very methodical and very intentional, and we were recording all analog as well. We're lovers of the old vintage equipment and finding out stories of this equipment and just letting that live through the equipment and then process that through the recording too.
So you have the old reel to reels?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yes. This particular album we recorded over in St. Pete with an independent studio, and yeah, they have all that equipment that we got to go play with. And that is called Yoko Phono. studio. So, yeah, we recorded there. And then just live. Yeah, like Nabetti was saying, it's you can allow the adrenaline to kick in. You can allow the interaction with the audience. If there is an audience, obviously COVID has adjusted that a bit. But what I was saying about our live performances was that we almost allow it to get out of control, you know, and if you're really using that surf analogy, you know, you're surfing through the chaos. Sometimes the ocean is really wavy and you're just, yeah, up and down all over the place, stop, go, and just going with the flow. So in a live performance, you can almost let it get to noise and then stop it with control and let it mellow out and have that contrast. All of those exist in the same room.
All right, let me go to one more song I wanted to point out. This one is TV is the title of another song from your album. Right, Alex, let me start with you, because I understand you wrote this one a while back, right? I'm wondering, how has this song evolved for you, the meaning of it, over time?
This one is definitely one of those that has kind of changed meanings, or has become more true over time. I just wrote it about the collective feeling of kind of dread and hopelessness that everyone kind of feels when they see all this stuff going on that we seemingly have no control over, and the clear fact that we're seeing that a few very key people are responsible for essentially mass suffering, and how to deal with that reality, and how to deal with everyone around you feeling hopeless. And kind of questioning, what are you going to do as an individual? What can you do as an individual?
Mm-hmm. Nabetti, let me finish with you. I, you know, again, as the 305 for life person, I wanted to know from you, Miami has gone through so much in its history and always finds a way to bounce back. It has taken a really big hit from this, and I'm wondering, what do you think? How is it going to change? What's going to be different on the other side of this when we talk about the music scene, entertainment, and so forth for artists?
I can't tell you what's going to be different, but I will tell you that Miami's not going to stop, because we are diehard, and we get hit by hurricanes, and we've been down in the dirts and in the dumps, and we come right back up. And it doesn't stop us. Miami's a really resilient town. And I guess it's the people that are from here. Like, we don't give up. That's why that whole 305 till I die thing is real, you know. And just like anybody, you know, they see things, you know, kind of go, you know, fall apart. But it's all about the recovery. The recovery is a masterpiece. And that's what's slowly happening. We're slowly trying to recover from what's happening. But there is no end point at any time soon for Miami. I don't see that coming at all. Unless we're underwater. And even so, like, we all have, like, paddle boards and canoes, you know? We all know how to swim. Surfboards, hey. But, yeah, I think challenges are really good. Because we all kind of break out of our routines and we find new ways of making things work. So if anything, it's a new awakening. And I always try to see the positive in things. And I think that it's going to be a beautiful day when the dust settles and we all come out again. And we all see each other and we're able to high five and hug again.
You just heard from Nabetti Osadio, Alex Mibuti, and Monica McGivern from the band Haute Tension, which means high voltage in French. Conversation is part of our series Live from the 305, and you can find more Live from the 305 on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, May 6th. Coming up next week on the program, the political situation in Colombia is rapidly deteriorating. Following a week of protests against the government over taxes and the COVID-19 response, 25 people have died and scores more have been injured. We're going to get the latest from Colombia and how the diaspora in South Florida is responding. Plus, our conversation with the iconic hip-hop artist turned football coach Luther Campbell, a.k.a. Uncle Luke. He started a new sports management agency developing the next generation of black athletes in pro sports. And a reminder, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we're reading Women and Salt by Gabriela Garcia. Remember, find us on Facebook at Sundial Book Club. We'd love to have you. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday. This program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.